Hi, welcome to episode 2 of our section on the Doctrine of Revelation. Last episode, we gave a general overview of the Doctrine of Revelation, which is the different ways that God has revealed himself to us. We gave a brief overview of the two different types of revelation, general and special. We said that general revelation is done through nature, and it's also done through science and philosophy and a few other things. But we can't learn everything that we need to know about God and his plan without him telling us some things directly. When God speaks to people directly, we call this special revelation. And this takes a form of God speaking directly to people with an audible voice, like when he did to Adam or to Jacob or to Moses. It can also be done through the words of the prophets, and it was done in the person of Jesus Christ and through the written words found in the Bible. Most of us have probably never heard the actual voice of God, and we don't have Jesus in the flesh with us to talk to and to ask questions like the apostles did. But we do have a collection of books that have been handed down for generations that proclaim to be the words of God. And we're going to take a few sessions to talk about the Bible now, because it is the primary source that we get our theology from. But depending on this book isn't without its own set of challenges. Now, the words in this book were written over 3,500 years ago for the Old Testament and about 2,000 years ago for the accounts of Jesus' life. And apart from Paul and Luke, most of these men were uneducated commoners. They were shepherds and fishermen. They weren't educated scribes and teachers. And what about the documents themselves? The original manuscripts are long gone. We don't even have copies of the originals or copies of the originals. What we have are copies of the copies of the copies of the originals, at best. So why should we trust the Bible? Why should we make it the guide that we continually turn to in our lives? Why should we believe it when it talks about Jesus is coming back to life? Or why should we believe it when John tells us how the world is going to end and what will happen to everyone on the day of judgment? Now, you may have heard many of these criticisms that I just laid out. You may have these doubts yourself. There's many reasons people give on why we should not trust the Bible, and I want to take time now to address those, because I do think that the Bible is trustworthy. In fact, I'm going to make the case today that no other book in history has been as well preserved as the Bible. We're going to take a top-down approach to examining the evidence for why we should trust the Bible. I like to picture it as if there's a person standing in a large room with a Bible like 30 or 40 feet away, and there's a bunch of roadblocks and obstacles between that person and the Bible that the person has to overcome before they have a clear path, right? The goal, of course, is for the person to open the Bible, read it, and have their lives transformed. But before that, we need to clear away a few of these obstacles so that they can have a clear path to the Bible. The first category of evidence we'll look at are external evidences. These are pieces of evidence that one can build a case around for why the Bible is worth investigating without even having to crack the Bible open. The second category we'll examine is the internal evidence. Are there clues inside the text itself that point towards the trustworthiness of the accounts that it contains? The first thing I want to consider is the Bible as an ancient work of history. One reason people reject the Bible is that it makes supernatural claims. But if we set all those claims aside for a minute and just consider it as an ancient work, how does it stand up next to other ancient works? Much of what we know about the ancient world and its figures comes from ancient writings, much like the Bible. So, how does the Bible compare to those? First, let's look at the life of Alexander the Great. We know a lot about his life, his military conquests, and many of the other things that he did. The information comes primarily from two authors, Arrian and Plutarch. Next, we have the biographies of the 12 Caesars, starting with Julius Caesar and going to Domitian. Julius Caesar wrote a lot about his life and conquests. We get info on the other Caesars from a Roman historian named Suetonius. Another historian from whom we get much of our knowledge regarding the first century Greco-Roman world is Livy. And we also have a historian named Tacitus who wrote biographies for Tiberius Caesar. He was the emperor that was on the throne when Jesus was executed. We know about ancient Greek culture and politics through the oration of a politician named Demosthenes. Thucydides gave us his great work on the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta. And finally, we have Herodotus, the father of history, who, in his work Histories, gave us a detailed account of the Greco-Persian War. Now, I know that's a lot of history and a lot of dates, but it'll all make sense here in a minute, I promise. With those things in mind, let's now go through the external evidence for why the Bible is trustworthy. Textual critics use several factors, including the language used, the absence of evidence, the inclusion of events, and other narrative clues, to help them determine when a text was first written. Historians agree that Jesus most likely died either 30 or 33 AD. Based on the criteria above, scholars have dated the manuscripts of the New Testament from 40 to 45 AD, which would be the first one being the Epistle of James, to about 95 AD, which would be Revelation. There are competing theories as to which gospel was written first, but the prevailing theory is that it was Mark between 50 and 55 AD. Now, 25 years between when an event occurred and when it was documented seems like a big gap. But consider this. Plutarch's writings on Alexander the Great came 400 years after Alexander's death. The sources for Tiberius Caesar, 80 to 180 years after his death. So, a 25-year time gap is nothing compared to some of the gaps that we have for some of our most famous ancient historical figures. As another comparison, let's take one of the most tragic events to happen in the U.S. history in the past several decades, 9/11. That was 23 years ago. I remember it well enough that I could write a few pages about it. And that's me, 3,000 miles away from the event, only seeing it on TV. Imagine all the things that the eyewitnesses of the actual events could still recall to this day, for the rest of their lives, really. So 25 years is nothing for those kind of impactful events. In his book, Cold Case Christianity, former homicide detective J. Warner Wallace gives a list of criteria he used in his investigations to determine if someone was a reliable eyewitness. First off, were they present? We can look at how they described the area the event took place in, certain things that were happening to that day, etc., and determine if they were actually present. For example, my 17-year-old daughter has been performing in musical theater since she was 5. Recently, she was in a performance of Beauty and the Beast. If someone said they saw her perform, they should be able to accurately describe the venue she performed in. They only perform in one venue. So if the person gets the venue wrong, then they weren't there. Next, were the accounts corroborated? Did anyone else say the same thing that the eyewitness did? Or did anyone else have details in their account that line up with this account? My wife and I both say we saw our daughter perform. If you interview us separately, parts of our account should be the same. We should both be able to tell you the role that she played, what her costume looked like, and the scenes that she was in, for instance. We also need to ask if they were accurate. Now, they could be wrong about a couple details, but they need to be accurate on the main details. For instance, my wife could probably tell you the pattern on the dress that she wore, but if you ask me, I would just say it was blue. And finally, were they biased? Does the person giving the account have anything to gain by fabricating a story, or maybe something to lose by telling the truth? Jim writes a chapter on each of these criteria in his book and shows how the gospel writers meet every single one of these criteria. In fact, it was because they met all the criteria that Jim started paying attention to what the report said, as an atheist. In other words, the people whose names are attributed to the Gospels are the ones who wrote them shortly after the events they record. We don't have one eyewitness account of the life of Jesus, we have four. All of the things that they record, the cities, the people, the buildings, the geography, they're all accurate to the time they record. Also, these men had nothing to gain and everything to lose by writing and doing what they did. They had no motivation to lie. Based on all of this, we can comfortably say that the Gospels were written by people who were actually there to witness the life of Jesus of Nazareth. The writings of the early followers of Jesus didn't stop with the apostles. We have writings from many of the early church fathers, who would have been students taught by the apostles. These would be people like Clement, Polycarp, and Ignatius. They continued the tradition of writing letters to churches giving them advice. They also wrote out many of their thoughts as they worked through theological topics and issues of the day. And many of their writings either directly quote the Bible or they are lessons and ideas from the teachings of Jesus that they rephrased. There are dozens of secondary sources in the first two centuries, Just by looking at the letters of three of these men, Clement, Polycarp, and Ignatius, we get the following ideas that are also taught in the New Testament. We get the idea that the Old Testament predicted Jesus' coming, that Jesus is divine. The apostles and many others learned directly from Jesus. Jesus performed miracles. Jesus' mother was a virgin when he was born. Jesus was a real person who lived, taught, cared for others, was arrested, and was executed. And Jesus rose from the dead as evidence of his divine nature. That sounds familiar, right? If the secondary sources say the same thing as the primary sources, then that's another reason to believe the primary sources, in this case, the Gospels. When working with ancient manuscripts, historians rely on multiple copies of an original work in order to ensure the copies that we have accurately represent the original. Up until the printing press was invented in the 1500s, everything was copied by hand. Scribes made mistakes. So the more copies we have for comparison, the closer we can get to what the original said. For example, if we have three manuscripts that say Jesus wept, and one that says, Jesus, the Son of the Most Holy, may he reign forever and ever, amen, wept, we can assume that the odd one out has the stuff added to it. If three manuscripts word it one way, and one words it a different way, you go with the ones that agree. Let me give you an example of how having multiple copies of a manuscript helps reconstruct the original. Let's say my buddy Charles and I plan to go on a hike on Saturday morning. We're going to drive out of town to this really cool trail up in the mountains. We have to coordinate a time for me to be picked up. And we all know that the wonders of autocorrect, so let's say I send him the following text. Pack me up at home around 6 a.m. We can grub breakfast in the wash. Okay, well that was an autocorrect fail, so I text him again. And I send this. Pick up at home me about 6 a.m. We can go brake fluid on the way. Well, I'm pretty sure he knows I don't want to get brake fluid, but because I like to be clear, I text him again. Me at Puck's house at 6 a.m. On the way, breakfast we could get. And then I just throw my hands up in frustration because autocorrect is not my friend, apparently. But you get the point. Where is he picking me up? And at what time? What are we doing after he gets me? So you can see having numerous copies for comparison can help you come to a conclusion about what the original message said. Even if there are copyist errors or things getting changed around a bit, you can still figure out what the original said. I listed the ancient historians at the beginning because I think it would be helpful to compare the New Testament documents with them. They gave us the works in which we get most of what we know about the ancient Greco-Roman world. You know, the figures, the wars, the way of life, the way their government worked, etc. And if the New Testament has a similar amount of copies for comparison, we should trust it the same way we do our other sources of ancient history. In a video entitled An Embarrassment of Riches, Dr. Dan Wallace gives these statistics for comparing the New Testament manuscripts to the works of other ancient authors. First, the ancient historians Livy, Tacitus, and Suetonius. For Livy, the earliest manuscripts we have of his work are from 300 years after he wrote them, and we have about 30 copies. For Tacitus, considered by many to be one of the greatest historians of the day, 1,000 years and 20 copies. Suetonius, for him we have about 8, but the earliest copies are from the 9th century. For Herodotus, remember he's the father of history, we have 8 copies. 8, the father of history. And their earliest manuscripts are from 1,000 years later. As you can see, much of what we know about ancient history comes from manuscripts that are copies from hundreds, if not 1,000 years after the originals were created. And we have between 8 and 20 copies for comparison to get the original text. So, how does the New Testament stack up? Well, now you're going to see why this section is called An Embarrassment of Riches. As far as copies go, we have about 5,800 manuscripts of the New Testament in Greek alone. We have another 10,000 in Latin, which started in the 2nd century. Hundreds more in Coptic, Syriac, Georgian, Gothic, Arabic, and many others. In total, we have around 15,000 copies not in Greek, and well over 20,000 if we include the Greek manuscripts. Now keep in mind, with these ancient documents, they aren't all complete copies. There are a lot of fragments and pieces missing. The earlier you go, the less there usually is of them left. That goes for both the New Testament and the other ancient works. But this isn't really an issue because we have multiple copies of the same thing to reference against each other, remember? Now let's talk about the age of the New Testament manuscripts. The oldest manuscripts we have, a fragment of the Gospel of John, is from AD 100 to 150. We have as many as 10 to 12 that can be dated to the 2nd century. Within 300 years, we have over 100 manuscripts in Greek alone. The average classical author has fewer than 20 copies of his works still in existence. For visual reference, if we took those manuscripts and stacked them on top of each other, that would be about a 4-foot-high stack. The New Testament? Almost a mile high. The final external reason we should trust the Bible is that many of the events it discusses are backed up by outside sources. Even better for our case, many of them are hostile to Christianity. None of these sources are praising Jesus or Christians, but we can gather lots of facts from their writings that do corroborate many of the historical claims in the Bible. Well, who are these sources? They are historians of the day who wrote about their dealings with Christians in their letters and books. There's many external sources in ancient history that document things about Jesus and his followers, and we're going to briefly look at six. First, we have Thallus. He was an ancient historian between 50 and 89 AD. Like many ancient historians, his works are lost to us today, but we know some of the things that he said based on someone else commenting about his writings. In the 3rd century, historian Julius Africanus writes, "On the whole world there pressed a most fearful darkness, and the rocks were rent by an earthquake, and many places in Judea and other districts were thrown down. This darkness Thallus in the 3rd book of his history calls, as it appears to me without reason, an eclipse of the sun." Here, Julius informs us that in one of his books about history, Thallus noted that the sky went dark on a given day when it should not have. Thallus didn't know what was going on, so he chalked it up to an unexpected eclipse. Julius goes on to describe the patterns and seasons of the month and why it could not have been an eclipse because it was the wrong time of the year for that to happen. Further on in the passage, he cites another ancient historian, Phlegon, who also documented an eclipse. Phlegon records that, in the time of Tiberius Caesar, at full moon, there was a full eclipse of the sun from the 6th hour to the 9th, manifestly that one of which we speak. But what has an eclipse in common with an earthquake, the rending of rocks, and the resurrection of the dead, and so great a perturbation throughout this universe? So not only did Phlegon record an eclipse, but he also recorded earthquakes at the time that Jesus was crucified. Next, we have Cornelius Tacitus, another ancient historian who lived between 56 and 120 AD. He wrote about Nero and the fires that destroyed Rome in his work, Annals. Tacitus records that Nero blamed the destruction of Rome on the Christians. He writes, "Yet no human effort, no princely largesse, nor offerings to the gods could make that infamous rumor disappear that Nero had somehow ordered the fire. Therefore, in order to abolish that rumor, Nero falsely accused and executed with the most exquisite punishments those people called Christians, who were infamous for their abominations. The originator of the name, Christ, was executed as a criminal by the procurator Pontius Pilate during the reign of Tiberius, and though repressed, this destructive superstition erupted again, not only through Judea, which was the origin of this evil, but also through the city of Rome, to which all that is horrible and shameful floods together and is celebrated." Tacitus goes on to document some of the things that Nero did to the Christians, and they aren't pretty. But here we have a Roman historian who is clearly a hostile witness. I mean, he said Christians were infamous for their abominations. And he records that Jesus was executed as a criminal under Pontius Pilate. Next, we have Mara Bar Serapion, who was a Syrian Stoic philosopher. In a letter he wrote to his son sometime after 73 AD, he writes, "What else can we say? When the wise are forcibly dragged off by tyrants, their wisdom is captured by insults, and their minds are oppressed and without defense. What advantage did the Athenians gain from murdering Socrates? Famine and plague came upon them as a punishment for their crime. What advantage did men of Samos gain from burning Pythagoras? In a moment, their land was covered with sand. What advantage did the Jews gain from executing their wise king? It was just after that their kingdom was abolished. God justly avenged these three wise men. The Athenians died of hunger, the Samians were overwhelmed by the sea, and the Jews, desolate and driven from their own kingdom, lived in complete dispersion. But Socrates is not dead because of Plato, neither is Pythagoras because of the status of Juno, nor is the wise king because of the new law that he laid down. So Mara writes to his son about how certain ancient cities faced calamity after they persecuted a major figurehead of the day. One of those cities he referred to is Jerusalem, and how the Jews were dispersed after Jesus was executed. Next, we have Pliny the Younger, who lived between 98 and 117 AD. He was a magistrate in the Roman Empire, which is kind of like a politician, and he wrote several letters back and forth with Emperor Trajan. In one of his letters, written in 113 AD, he describes putting Christians on trial and some of the things he discovered. He writes, "They asserted, however, that the sum and substance of their fault or error had been that they were accustomed to meet on a fixed day before dawn and sing responsively a hymn to Christ as to a God, and to bind themselves by oath, not to some crime, but not to commit fraud, theft, or adultery, not falsify their trust, not to refuse to return a trust when called upon to do so. When this was over, it was their custom to depart and to assemble again to partake of food, but ordinary and innocent food. Even this, they affirmed, they had ceased to do after my edict by which, in accordance with your instruction, I had forbidden political associations. Accordingly, I judged it all the more necessary to find out what the truth was by torturing two female slaves who were called deaconesses. But I discovered nothing else but depraved, excessive superstition." So, in the letters written in 113 AD, we have a hostile witness recording that Christians were worshiping Christ as a god, and that they held to superstitions, like that he rose from the grave. So, for Christians to have existed this early on means that Christ had to have existed this early on. Finally, we have Flavius Josephus. Josephus was an ancient Jewish historian who was quite prolific. A great deal of what we know about the ancient world comes from Josephus. He lived between 37 and 100 AD. One of his major works is known as Antiquities. There's a passage in it where he writes about Jesus and his execution. This passage is so famous to historians it's been given a specific name, the Testimonium Flavium. It reads, "About this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, if indeed one ought to call him a man. For he was one who performed surprising deeds and was a teacher of such people as accept the truth gladly. He won over many Jews and many of the Greeks. He was the Messiah. And when upon the accusation of the principal men among us, Pilate had condemned him to a cross, those who had first come to love him did not cease. He appeared to them spending a third day restored to life, for the prophets of God had foretold these things and a thousand other marvels about him. And the tribe of the Christians, so called after him, has still to this day not disappeared." Now, many people will object to this passage. And can you see why? Josephus was a Jew, but the author of this passage holds some very Christian beliefs. So, more than likely, a scribe who was a Christian embellished some of the passages and added things to that Josephus didn't really say. But, for us, that's okay, because here's what we get if we remove those questionable passages. "About this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, for he was one who performed surprising deeds and was a teacher. He won over many Jews and many of the Greeks. And when upon the accusation of the principal men among us, Pilate had condemned him to a cross, those who had first come to love him do not cease. And the tribe of Christians so called after him has still to this day not disappeared." So, even in this much more neutral version, we get a number of important pieces of evidence. Jesus lived, he won over many Jews and Greeks, the principal men among the Jews had him crucified, Pilate oversaw the execution via crucifixion, his followers claimed to have seen him after he died, and they still persist throughout Rome today. That's six different non-Christian sources that we have to back up the events of the New Testament. We actually have more sources for the life of Jesus than we do for Julius Caesar. So, what claims from the New Testament are supported by these sources? Here are some of the facts that they attest to, as well as the sources that back up those facts. Number one, Jesus lived. He was a Jew. He was a wise teacher. Jesus was an accurate predictor of future events. He was brought up for execution by Jewish leaders. Jesus was executed by crucifixion. The crucifixion was administered by Pontius Pilate. Tiberius was the emperor at the time of the execution. The sky was darkened on the day Jesus died. There were earthquakes on the day Jesus died. We continue. Groups of Jesus' followers existed. Early Christians believed supernatural events revolving around the life of Jesus. Early Christians met regularly to worship Jesus as a god. The early church consisted of many different ethnic groups, free people, slaves, men, and women. People of low social status, women and slaves, held offices in the church. Early Christians had a strong moral code that they followed, and the early Christians were persecuted. Now, these sources don't seem to believe the supernatural events that happened in the New Testament, but they do document the natural events like the earthquakes and the sky darkening on the day Jesus was executed. And even though these sources didn't believe in the supernatural events, more importantly, they tell us that the first Christians did. So, despite being a collection of writings from over 2,000 years ago, we can trust that the Bible we have today is what was written originally. It was written shortly after the events that it records. The people who authored it were eyewitnesses to the events that they document. Many of the things from the New Testament can be found in contemporary secondary sources. We can follow what the students of the authors believed to see that the messages were unaltered. We have tens of thousands of copies of the manuscripts to make sure that we can accurately reproduce the originals, and even non-Christians of the day back up some of the things found in the New Testament. No other historical work can make those claims, and yet we trust them. So why not the Bible? Now, we move on to the internal evidence for why we should trust the Bible. Remember, in the beginning, I talked about removing roadblocks. At this point, we've used things from outside the Bible to get people to hopefully at least give it a shot. We could picture it like they used to be 50 feet away, and now at least they're standing in front of the Bible ready to open it up. They're probably still skeptical. They've heard about the talking snakes and the talking donkeys and people coming back from the dead. And a lot of that sounds like myth and fairy tale. But at least now they're ready to have a look inside. Now, there's still a lot of obstacles we have to deal with inside the Bible, too. I was certainly that way once. See, I knew it was written by men. I knew men make mistakes. I know men seek power and have agendas. I knew it was written in ancient languages and it had been translated over and over and over again. So how could I trust a book that was written 2,000 years ago by people who make mistakes and have desires to craft a narrative that puts them in power? Now, my position has obviously changed. So what changed? How did I go from being highly critical of the Bible to making it one of my favorite things to make the case for, and being convinced that it's God's Word? Well, first and foremost, I actually read it. See, the whole time I was criticizing the Bible, I had never really read it. I mean, I had read parts of it when I was in Sunday school as a kid, but after I had gone off to college, I never cracked the Bible open again. Once I did start reading it, several of my hurdles, and a lot of the most common charges people make, were removed pretty quickly. First off, my roadblock of the agenda. Why did I think there was an agenda? Because I am a Gen Xer, and Gen Xers think every institution has a hidden agenda. My only basis to think this of the church was that it had become a success, and it had a lot of influence. I had this image in my head of the massive stone churches in Europe, full of finely crafted items of unspeakable value. And I grew up in the era of Jimmy Swaggart and Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. I heard preachers on TV say that the viewers' salvation was connected with how much money they would send into their ministry. And I saw sex scandal after sex scandal where women were taken in by the draw of power and charisma. Therefore, there had to be a nefarious agenda of manipulation of the masses by men of power. But when I read the New Testament, I saw the life of Jesus of Nazareth. I saw the lives of the apostles after Jesus' resurrection, and I read their teachings. These men lived a life of meager means. They traveled light. They didn't make impassioned pleas for people to give them money like I saw the televangelists of the 80s and the 90s do. In fact, I saw just the opposite of what I had seen on TV. In his letters, Paul often reminds the recipients how he worked amongst them as a tent maker to earn a wage. That's Acts 18:3-4. That he never asked them to support him while he was there. That's Acts 20:33-34. And that guys who were coming around preaching and asking for money shouldn't be trusted. That's in 1 Timothy 6:5 and Acts 20:33. There was nothing in these pages that set up the structure of power. There were no words about gaining financial wealth. In fact, they were encouraged to live modestly and give to others. There was no talk of coming under compliance of authority apart from God and Jesus. The apostles in Acts gave all the glory to God whenever they performed miracles. A few times, people fell to the ground and started worshiping the apostles as gods, but the apostles quickly stopped it. See Acts 14, 8-18. Paul even gave the church in Galatia instructions to ignore him if he changed anything he had originally taught them. That's Galatians 1, verse 8. As for scoring with the ladies, the apostles did and taught to do the exact opposite. Titus 1, 6 and 1 Timothy 3, 2. And at that time, this teaching was completely counter to the culture. Most men had a wife to bury him with children and manage the house. He had a servant girl or two, and he had a favorite prostitute at the local temple. But Jesus and the apostles taught one man, one woman. Paul even encouraged those who could do it to remain celibate. That's 1 Corinthians 7, 8 through 9. What I quickly realized was that the church I saw now wasn't the church I saw when the New Testament was written. The church had gained money and power, and there were certainly plenty of instances of sexual impropriety, even abuse. But these things weren't what was originally taught. One thing I had always thought was that the Gospels were too different from one another. You would think that if the book was directed by a supernatural force, the authors would at least be able to get their story straight. But the gospel accounts aren't the same. The accounts aren't told in the same order. Some have parts that others don't, and in some areas they don't appear to agree on the number of things, like how many people visited Jesus' tomb and how many angels they saw. When I read J. Warner Wallace's book Cold Case Christianity, I realized that the slight differences account actually helped show the authors were eyewitnesses. Wallace talks about interviewing eyewitnesses in his book. And when you interview eyewitnesses, it's a bad sign if their stories are exactly the same. That means they cooperated together before the cops showed up to make sure they were telling the same story. In reality, though, each one of us pays attention to certain details differently. If you ask two people who witnessed something to describe it, they'll probably have some overlap. But they will toss in different details based on things that were important to them or the things that they could see based on their perspective. We talked about this earlier in the section on eyewitness testimony. Another show my daughter was in recently was The Music Man. If you asked my wife, who saw the performance from the audience perspective, she would tell you about the things going on downstage. For example, in this scene, she would have told you that my daughter, on the left, was standing next to the piano with a feather duster. I would have said, no, I didn't see that. Why? Because I am offstage to the left of the shot, and Izzy's back is to me. I couldn't see the feather duster. Now, if you asked me, though, you would have seen this, and I would have told you about all of the stuff from the stage crew perspective, how we got stuff off and on the stage, how the actors hide behind the set pieces, etc. And I would have told you how Izzy was dancing behind the set piece and making faces. My wife couldn't see that, but I could. But we would have both told you what role our daughter had, and we would have told you what songs that she sang, and what her costume looked like. The gospel accounts are the same way. Each author saw and heard different details of the same events. They were also writing for different audiences. Matthew's gospel is written for a Jewish audience. You can tell because he quotes more Old Testament scriptures than any other author. And Luke's purpose was to give an orderly account. He felt the need to do this because the other accounts of the time weren't done in an orderly way. Matthew and Mark are organized in more thematic ways than chronological. Let's have a look at one section of the Gospels to demonstrate how we can resolve many apparent contradictions. Here's the passage in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that describes Jesus' tomb being empty. In Matthew 28, 1-6, it says, "Now after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from the heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothing white as snow. And for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men. But the angel said to the women, 'Do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here, for he has risen, as he said. Come, see the place where he lay.'" Mark 16, 1-6 has, "When the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome brought spices, so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb, and they were saying to one another, 'Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?' And looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled back. It was very large. And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, dressed in a white robe, and they were alarmed. And he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him." Luke 24, 1-7 has the account this way. "But on the first day of the week, at early dawn, they went to the tomb, taking spices that they had prepared. And they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. But when they went in, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were perplexed about this, behold, two men stood by them in dazzling apparel. And as they were frightened and bowed their faces to the ground, the men said to them, 'Why do you seek the living among the dead? He is not here, but he has risen. Remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified and on the third day rise.'" And finally, John writes it this way. "Now on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said to them, 'They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have laid him.'" Now, you may read those accounts side by side and think, are these guys even describing the same scene? How many people went to the tomb? Matthew has two. Mark lists three. Luke just says they. And John only says one name. And just how many angels were there? One or two? And where were they? Inside or outside? But remember, these accounts are eyewitness testimony, and eyewitnesses can describe things differently as certain details stick out to them. For example, I ride the bus to work every morning. If my wife asks someone about my bus ride, one person might say, "Dave got on the bus and went to work." Someone else might say, "Dave got on the bus with some high school kids. He got off on the corner of Main and First." And a third person might say, "Dave got on the bus and was talking with another guy. They got off the bus next to Ralph's. Dave walked one way, and the other guy went into the store." Now, even though none of those accounts are exactly the same, none of them are contradictory. In each of the accounts, "I got on the bus and then got off the bus." Now, they would be contradictory if one person said, "Dave got on the bus, nobody else got on the bus at the same time, and he didn't get off the bus until it made its way back to the bus station." But if one person described the scene as, "Dave got on the bus," and someone else described it as, "Dave and some other people got on the bus," there's no contradiction. So with that in mind, let's go look at the Bible passages again. Matthew says, "Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb." Mark says, "Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome brought spices." Luke says, "They went to the tomb, taking spices that they had prepared." And John says, "Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early while it was still dark." So do any of these accounts say only Mary Magdalene went? No, and I'm pretty sure "they" means more than one, which also means at least two, which also means one and some more. So just listing Mary Magdalene doesn't mean that others weren't there too. Does that make sense? Having accounts that differ slightly is actually a good thing. Imagine you're a cop, and you have to go investigate a crime scene. If you interview four witnesses, and they all tell the exact same story, what are your thoughts? Probably that they got together to make sure they had their story straight, right? But if they differ a bit, one adds this detail, one adds another detail, but they still tell the same story overall, that makes it more trustworthy. The Gospels give the same accounts of the life and ministry of Jesus. They differ in some details, but not at their core. In fact, if they were almost identical retellings, we should worry that they conspired to make sure they got all of their facts straight. Another thing that stuck out to me when I read through the Gospels is how the followers of Jesus were portrayed. Keep in mind that the apostles are the men who founded the church after Jesus left. These are the pillars. These are the men who wrote the vast majority of the New Testament. Many traditions even put the title saint before their names. And yet, when you read through the Gospels, they look more like the 12 stooges than the 12 saints. They frequently misunderstand Jesus' teachings. They argue with one another. Jesus rebukes them constantly, and they often act out foolishly. And the ultimate sign that they didn't get what was going on was that they all ran and hid when Jesus was arrested. They turned their backs on him. Historians have a term for this kind of account, and it's a way for them to evaluate if something's true or not. It's called embarrassing testimony. If you want to make yourself look good, you don't include stuff that makes you look bad. You only put in the embarrassing stuff if you're telling the truth. Look at Peter and the picture that's painted of him in the Gospels. Peter is the man that the Roman Catholic Church claimed as the first pope. And yet in the pages of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, he looks like a fool. He almost drowns in the sea trying to walk on water. Jesus calls him Satan at one point, and he lops off the ear of someone when Jesus gets arrested, which Jesus scolds him for. And he also denies that he even knows Jesus later on when he's asked. All throughout the book of Acts, the apostles are chased out of town after town, beaten, arrested, and even killed. They aren't portrayed as glorious conquering heroes. They don't walk into a place, start waving their arms around, and the people lovingly fall in line. In fact, they often meet a lot of opposition, and it's all written down in the pages of the Bible. So finally, and this is one of the biggest eye-openers for me, as I read through the pages of the Gospels, I realized Jesus got it right. He accurately described how the hearts of mankind worked. He accurately described people's motivations, and he accurately described what was going to happen to his followers. All the scandals we've seen in the church, greedy pastors, the sexual improprieties, the thirst for power, and the craving for attention that some fell into, Jesus called all of that. He said all of those guys would show up and gave reasons for why it would happen. I came to really know Jesus in 2014. There were a few reasons I started reading the Bible, but one of them was because I saw a lot of hate being turned towards Christians in the public square. Every other day, I heard statements like, "Christians hate, insert marginalized group here." And I thought to myself, I don't remember being taught to hate anyone when I used to go to church. In fact, it was just the opposite. So imagine my surprise when I read what Jesus taught, and I didn't see any guarantees of material success or a life without problems. Jesus predicted the exact opposite, actually. He gave principles that could unite everyone, but he knew the hearts of men. He predicted that his words would be really divisive. He said there's a cost associated with following him. You'll lose friends, you'll lose family, and your livelihood may be affected, and you may even lose your life. There was one other thing that Jesus got right that really sealed the deal for me. More important than realizing there was no hidden agenda, that the Gospels weren't contradictory, and that the church I saw wasn't how Jesus taught it to be, more important than any other roadblock that I had put up, I realized that Jesus got me right. This man from Nazareth who lived 2,000 years ago, through the writings of his followers, had called out every single thing I saw wrong with myself. No matter what front I would put up on the outside, I knew the dark, ugly dirtiness that lived within, and he did too. Now, I'm not trying to turn this into my personal testimony, but for the sake of brevity, let's just say that the other thing that I found in the pages of the Bible was grace, forgiveness, love, and patience. Those things saved my life. So after I had all of my roadblocks removed, and I saw that the original manuscripts were written early by people who were actually there to witness the events, that the authors didn't have an agenda, that the accounts were corroborated by outside hostile sources, that we have an extraordinary amount of copies that allow us to determine what the original said, and how Jesus accurately described the world and how it works, including me, I was left with a choice. I could either bury my head in the sand and try to continue stumbling through life, or I could turn to the words of the designer of life and seek his wisdom for how I ought to live my life. For me, that choice was pretty clear.